all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
The 10-Minute Timeout is a mini podcast that brings Mississippi sports stories to life. Join me, Lacey Alexander, as I learn more about the teams, athletes, staff, and programs that make our state proud. One-on-one interviews with influential playmakers paint a clear picture for listeners of how Mississippi sports inspire and energize our community. New episodes released every other Friday on your favorite podcasting app.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Southern Remedy. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, Professor of Internal Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and you are listening to the original Southern Remedy program. That's right. During this hour, we are giving you the opportunity to call in with any type of medical question about yourself or somebody else in your family, or maybe even a friend that you have. That could be a symptom of something, maybe a new medication, maybe a potential side effect. Maybe it's just something you want clarification on. Whatever the question is related to your health care, you can always email. That email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. Beautiful weather outside here in central Mississippi walking in. I wish I could walk a long way. I probably should have taken the time and parked, I don't know, maybe a mile away to just enjoy the weather, because it is beautiful out there. Finally have figured out, I talk all the time, probably ad nauseum to all of our regular listeners about my allergies, but I know a lot of you suffer from the same thing. I think I've got my regimen just down pat, knocking on any kind of wood I can find as I say that. But I hope you are enjoying this beautiful spring weather that we have. And certainly it's, you know, that's the sweet window between the miserable wet cold of the South and the extreme heat. So take the time to improve your health with that. Get out there and do some movement and some physical activity and accomplish those goals. We're sort of out of the two-month period when most people sort of drop off of their New Year's resolutions, but maybe you need to revisit some of those or maybe change some of those a little bit, but this would be an excellent opportunity to do that. This is Southern Remedy, where you can call in with any type of medical question that you might have. You can email us at remedy@mpbonline.org. Speaking of emails, we got one recently. This is from a 78-year-old listener. And for many years, he says that his resting pulse rate has been in around 48 to 50 beats per minute. He's very active and engages in strenuous activity or physical work from time to time, but his heart rate goes up appropriately with that. He doesn't have any chest pain. He was entering a weight loss program at the advice of a doctor and got a physical along with a stress test and several other cardiovascular tests that were done, just because probably of his age. And also had an echocardiogram to assess the function of his heart. All of these were normal, but the cardiologist was a little bit concerned about his lower pulse rates, particularly in the 40s. He was put on a statin drug because of his overall cardiovascular risk. And his main question is, can a lowered resting pulse rate be the result of taking statins? What should I do about this, if anything? So do appreciate this listener and the call. Heart rates are variable person to person. So a lot of people, their resting heart rate, in other words, when you are sitting still, not doing anything, usually in the morning, you're not dehydrated, you haven't just exercised, you know, before that, your resting heart rate it typically is right around 60 to 75 beats per minute if you're male or female. So that is a general range. However, if you are typically speaking, for most people, if you're more physically active, your resting heart rate will be lower than that. And if you're very, very active, I'm talking about probably the top 5% of people, your heart rate may be even lower than that. For instance, when I was in my early 20s and 30s and doing a lot more running than I'm doing now, my resting heart rate was as low as 42 to 45 beats per minute. So that's pretty low, but that's indicative of how well your heart is pumping blood. And that's a little bit outside the spectrum, though, on the lower end. The upper end, if it gets much over 75, 80 beats a minute, then if you're inactive and sedentary and not really doing anything, then it might be a little bit elevated. But the biggest thing here, I would say, is a heart rate anywhere from 40 to 50 beats per minute that's resting. If you're not having any symptoms at any age, it's probably not a big deal. But as we get older, you can have first-degree heart block that might slow your heart rate down, and you have no symptoms because of your exercise reserve that you've built up over time. So I would lean towards the cardiologist to look at that. So that's going to show up on an EKG or maybe even an extended monitoring of your heart's electrical activity, like a Zio patch, which is it's the newest Holter monitor. A lot of us would remember those old Holter monitors that had electrodes on your chest. And then basically you wear this big pack from anywhere from 24 hours to maybe a week or two. The new ones are much smaller. They tape it to your chest. It's less invasive. You can go about your day doing everything. So I'm not aware that statins would lower your heart rate at all. So that might just be a coincidence in this case. They typically don't act on those pathways that influence the heart and the electrical activity of the heart. And I've never seen that as a side effect in the patients that I treat. So can't make that connection. But I don't know if a cardiologist has looked at it and said, yeah, your heart rate's lower, but your functional activity is good. It increases appropriately with activity. You're not having any shortness of breath or chest pain at a moderate degree of activity in what you're doing. I think you probably could just watch that over time, even at 78. But I would lean towards what the heart, what the cardiologist is saying about that. And they may even suggest too they may want you to see an electrophysiology physiologist, which is a cardiologist that has some additional training in sort of the electrical activity of the heart. But by and large, if you're very active and consistent about that over time, your resting heart rate will tend to be lower. So hope that helps your question. And that email address, if you have a question that you just don't have the time or maybe you can't call in, is remedy@mpbonline.org. We're going to go to David from Horn Lake. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you could give me some info about how doctors go about assessing memory problems. I'm 68 years old and seem like I'm having severe problems with short-term memory. I don't know if I'm having what they call senior moments, if it's normal, just normal problems with just getting older, or if it's maybe early signs of some shape, form, or fashion of dementia. I want to know if there's a blood test and I'm not probably making an appointment with my primary care physician and express my concerns with him. Is there any buzzwords or tests that I should really kind of nudge him to see about doing? How do you flag memory problems?
Sure. That's a great question, David. So, there's a misconception among a lot of people that dementia is a normal thing. And that is one that a lot of people will, that are the most concerned about as they get older. It is not normal to have dementia as you get older. That is an abnormal condition. But memory loss, small lapses in memory, for instance, not being able to recall as quickly the names of people, where you put your keys, things like that, that's sort of the normal case. It can be pretty pervasive sometimes and just annoying. But you usually, if you can get back to that in a few minutes and you're like, oh yeah, I remember that guy's name, that's okay. There are some tests that we do to assess this as we get older. And I would recommend that everybody have these tests, particularly if you're having some concerns about short-term memory loss. By the way, short-term memory loss is the thing that gets affected more than long-term memory loss. So long-term things that are sort of solidified in the brain, they persist for very much longer. Even in patients that have dementia, they usually can remember things that happened maybe 30, 40, 70 years ago, but they may not can remember what happened 5 minutes ago. And that's fairly normal for those conditions. But there aren't really any lab tests, although they may want to do lab tests that can affect your memory. For instance, your thyroid function, which the thyroid gland sits in the front part of your neck on both sides of your vocal cord, looks sort of like a butterfly in shape, and it controls your metabolic activity, which really affects all the body's processes. If it's malfunctioning and not producing enough hormone, then that can affect your memory and your cognitive performance. But there are a couple of screening tools for this. There's a mini mental status exam, and part of that, one of the components is your short-term memory. So you'll be standardized by giving you a couple of objects to remember and then come back to that in a few minutes as they move on through the testing. That's not the only thing they test, though. So there's a lot of other things that they would ask questions about. There are some things that they would ask you to do, like to draw a clock face. Like they'll have the numbers of, they'll say they'll have a circle. And you basically had to put the numbers on that circle like they would be on a clock. And then the minute hand and the hour hand on there too. And you might think, well, what does that have to do with anything? Actually, it's very specific for how our brain puts together spatial information and expresses that in a written form. So again, there's multiple of these tests. Some of my patients, sometimes they're like, you know, I don't want to take this. It's sort of offensive. It's just like any other test. If you think about it, you know, athletes have tests all the time. They have time trials. They have different kind of drills that assess their abilities. This is just another thing that assesses your ability to do various things. It's to see how good is your brain really working with that. And you'd be surprised. You can be fooled by that. If you're the patient, you know, a patient may say, I can do just fine. I can do all the activities that I've been doing in the past, but we don't really have the capacity a lot of times to objectively say that. We really need these tests to do that. If the screening test, which has to be performed by somebody that's familiar with that, so that can be your physician, it can be a nurse, it can be somebody who's a tech in that office, that is a PA, nurse practitioner that can administer that test. And then if you screen out that there might be a problem in one of those areas, and again, short-term memory is just one of them, then they may want to refer you for a full battery of cognitive behavioral testing. And that may be just with you. There may be some things that they want to get input from other people too, who are around you a lot, to really tease that out. The best place I know here, at least in central Mississippi, I know David's from Horn Lake. I'm not familiar around that area, but I would imagine there probably are a couple of geriatricians up there that are very versed in doing that. We have the Mind Center here, MIND at UMMC, and they do a lot of cognitive behavioral testing. And sometimes, you know, everybody's like, well, why can't we just do a blood test and a CT scan or an MRI of my head? Won't that tell you the same information? It actually doesn't. And they don't really correlate well. In other words, you could get a CT scan of somebody who's 80, who knocks the top off of the screening test, and they may have abnormalities on their CT scan that they may be there the rest of their life, and it might be the same as a person who's 80 with severe Alzheimer's dementia, but have similar results on that CT scan. So the scans don't always correlate with what's going on with that person. They can help, but if the person's performing okay, it doesn't really matter at that point. I know there's a lot of interest and a lot of testing out there with newer testing methods that can pick up on Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Don't forget, Alzheimer's is not the only type of dementia. There's others. But those are still not prime time yet. And we've talked a lot on this program about some of the risk factors for that. Probably some of the biggest risk factors are controlling things like blood pressure, diabetes, your cholesterol, because all those little blood vessels feed those brain cells. So if those blood vessels are clogged up in one place, it's a good chance that they're going to be clogged up in your brain. And that can cause a lot of damage over time. So Yeah.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, go ahead, David.
It's part B to my question. Without having any names or whatnot for trademark problems, this, that, and other, you see commercials on TV that they supposedly have a study on a certain brand that has supplements that's supposed to help your memory and protect your memory, this, that, and other. Are you aware of, or is there someplace I look up that they've had a double-blind placebo study that's not just snake oil or cherry-picking or whatever, a supplement that you can take that is readily available on the shelves and whatnot that will actually do what they claim it will do, or are just very expensive vitamins?
Very expensive vitamins. That part is totally true. But no, there is not one that has a large population that they have tested this on, as you mentioned, in a double blind fashion where they gave a dummy pill to somebody that looks exactly like what they're trying to test to half of the people, and then the other people they gave the active supplement that has shown improvement. So all of those, there's a lot of advertising for them and a lot of anecdotal evidence. And keep in mind, too, everybody on that TV screen, they don't even have to have memory problems. They may be testimonies there. If you look at the fine print, a lot of times it'll say these are actors. So keep that in mind, too. But, yeah, I would veer away from that. It's a waste of your money, in my opinion. It probably is not going to hurt you in most instances, except in the wallet with a wallet biopsy, as we say. That's where we are right now on that. So there's much more evidence with eating healthy, physical activity, and controlling those other things that contribute to dementia.
All right, thank you.
All right, David, thank you for calling. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. I'm not the best with numbers unless they're attached to clinical situations. It's amazing. I can remember patients' labs sometimes 6 months, maybe a year previously. But if you ask me an address or a phone number and ask me to recall it, my brain just like trashes that. It's like, yeah, it's like a golden retriever, like sit. And then 5 seconds later, it's like, I don't remember you telling me to sit. We are here for you today. That's right. We are here to answer your questions about any kind of healthcare problem that you might have. Maybe it's a screening question like David, our previous caller, asked. Maybe it is something that you're taking that you want to know, hey, how does this work? Does it really work? What are the potential side effects? Maybe it's a new diagnosis that somebody gave you and you just didn't have enough time to ask all those questions or thought about some questions later. We are here to help you get those answers or to point you in the right direction. Or if you're not able to call, we know a lot of our listeners aren't able to listen to us when we're live. That email address that you can send those questions is remedy@mpbonline.org. And speaking about listening to all of our MPB programs, you can just search for those on your favorite podcasting app, whatever that might be, and search for us there. I'm sure you can download it and you can listen to it whenever your heart's desire. Maybe you're up in the middle of the night and you're like, you know what? Dr. Jimmy puts me to sleep every time I listen to him. That's why we don't listen while I'm driving. You can do that at night if that's what symptoms you get from me. But that is available to listen to us whenever. Health is one of those things that people neglect until they actually start having problems, and it tends to be later in the game. So preventive medicine is something that we've identified in the last 20 to 30 years has been very important. In fact, we have new specialties now like preventive medicine that help out a lot. A lot of times they're physicians that get extra training after medical school within that discipline. And they look for all kinds of different preventive ways to do that. And amongst our workforces, particularly in larger organizations, they may have a health officer that has a preventive medicine or occupational health background. And part of their job is not only treating things that happen or identifying things that happen on the job, but trying to prevent that too. A healthier workforce is one that's going to be more productive. And we do think about those things on a bigger, broader level. I talk about that with my patients, talked about that with several patients yesterday that I saw in clinic yesterday morning. you know, your health, even though you might not have a lot of symptoms, there's a lot of bleed over into things that can be enjoyable for you. And I've started shifting a little bit, you know, advising people, you know, think about how you want to live your life in the next 10 to 20 years, particularly in my patients who are making that transition out of a job, maybe into retirement. What is that going to look like? What do you want to do? And whatever you want to do, why don't we match up, you know, sort of a program, a plan that can help you get there from a health standpoint. If you want to be able to hike and see a lot of sights in national parks when you're 80, then maybe we need to be thinking about your cardiovascular health, your joint health, design a program that can start looking at that right now so that you might be able to ensure that you can be able to do those kinds of things, or at least have a better chance of doing those. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. We're going to go to Ruth from Yazoo County. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning. I heard or read a statistic of the COVID death rate. It was 2,000 people, but I can't remember if that's nationally or and is it weekly or when? I can't remember, but I was telling my neighbor, and she said, oh, that's not reliable or true because they inflate the death rate in order to get more money from the government. And I said, well, why would they just stop at 2,000? And she said, if you went over that, people would get suspicious.
Yeah.
And I know that we're severely under-vaxxed. So I wondered, how true is this about the money, and what do we do about it, if anything?
Yeah, and I don't have the up-to-date information to correlate that right now, so I'm just trusting you on those numbers. I haven't actually looked at it in a while. But it is true that because we had so many patients in the hospital, I hear this a lot, and, you know, like, hey, you doctors just, you know, doctored the numbers, so to speak, and increased it so you could just get more money. You know, I can assure you firsthand, at University of Mississippi Medical Center during COVID, we had so many patients that were in the hospital and overflowing into our ER that we actually turned a parking garage into an ICU. So this is sort of a third world fix for the problem. That's how many patients we had that were sick enough, not just with COVID, but with COVID and the complications of COVID, to where they had to have an ICU bed and some of them on ventilators. And we had to overflow to a makeshift ICU that was in a parking garage. So walls were built. So, you know, I during the pandemic, certainly there was a lot of that. And to support the healthcare system, which we came pretty near close to collapse, we're still seeing the effects of that, particularly with smaller hospitals in Mississippi and other places. The federal government did give money, a little extra money per person that was admitted with COVID. So it wasn't, I don't think it was totally based on the death rate. It was more on the diagnosis. But all of those, there's audits for that, and there's ways to look at that. And, you know, I have found, though, that COVID was so disruptive for a number of things. It disrupted all of our lives. You know, I took an oath to do the best I can to take care of patients no matter what. I came in on the tail end of sort of the understanding more about HIV and AIDS. And I can still remember having patients that I took care of with full-blown AIDS, which we don't really see that much anymore because of the treatment that we have. And there was a lot of mistrust. There was a lot of divisiveness about the time and misunderstanding about that disease process. And I saw similarities with COVID that were sort of amplified. And I think a lot of this stems from, you know, yeah, all of our lives were disrupted in so many different ways, whether you were a small business owner where you lost your business, whether you lost your social contacts and now you're having depression and anxiety problems that are still prevalent there. Or whether you actually lost a loved one or multiple people to COVID. One of my patients, you know, lost two family members that were primary family members, and then five other people in his extended family to COVID within a year. So I push back a little bit about this because I think it's insensitive to the people who were affected in all those different ways. Mm-hmm. But what I think we need some sensibility and some clear thought process on this is we don't need to just throw away ever wearing a mask because it doesn't work because we're attaching that with COVID, or we don't need to say all vaccines don't work now because of COVID. So I think there's a lot of transference of the experiences that a lot of people had with that. And I think we have the opportunity to learn a whole lot. Now, thankfully, it's where we are now because of how many people who have gotten COVID and survived. Certainly, we've had tons of people who have died and worldwide and in the U.S. But thankfully now, because of the people who've been exposed to it and vaccinated or both, and I'm one of those in that latter category because I had COVID once, but I was vaccinated four times before that. The severity of the illness is much less at this point, thankfully. And I think vaccines still work. There's still plenty of data that supports, particularly if you're older right now and you get vaccinated against COVID, there's much less chance of complications, much less chance of you getting admitted to the hospital, much less chance of you getting long COVID symptoms, which are real. I've seen them in patients. So we have that data to support that. And I push back a good bit on all the misinformation that's out there. And I'm not even aware that we're getting any extra money at this point for COVID patients, and that really we're not seeing a lot of admissions with COVID. We still see a good bit, but certainly not to the point that we were before. And I think that's a good theory you had, too. Like, why not just push it up higher? That certainly wasn't. There were documented ways that you had to submit that. So I think that's a good point to bring up. So very respectfully and kindly, I would say, you know, I don't think that's really the truth about that.
Okay. And, you know, we had two neighbors had to be flown, one to Memphis and one to Oxford, because the hospital beds were full in Jackson.
Yeah, it was sad. We had. And it wasn't just COVID either. There were a lot of patients that needed other things. And, you know, that was a big issue, too. It was access to care. You know, in a lot of ways, we had to get creative with virtual visits during that time. And, you know, Mississippi, I think, was hit a little bit harder than other places because we already have access problems, even on a good, you know, in the good year. So I think you're right.
Well, thank you, Doctor.
All right, Ruth, thank you for calling. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. Dr. Jimmy with it this morning, answering your calls and questions about any kind of healthcare question that you might have. That number to call is 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. We're going to go to David from Grenada. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good morning. And first of all, I want to say thank you for hopefully answering my question, because I have no idea what's going on.
All right. Well, I'll do my best.
I've had this all my life. It's never gotten worse, but it happens like two or three times a year or so. But it's a pain in my heart region. And then when it starts, I have to stop whatever it is I'm doing. And I can't even breathe deeply. It's very painful. And then after 3, 4, 5 minutes, it just goes away. It just swoops in like a ghost and then leaves. And I've always had this, and I was just curious, you know, if you could make an educated guess on what that might be.
Sure. Let me ask you a couple more questions, David. Do you, and you said this has been going on your whole life?
As far back as I can remember.
Okay, and how old are you now?
74.
Okay.
I mean, it's been happening at least 40 years, but it's not very often, but it's there.
And would you describe that pain as like a sharp stabbing pain or a dull pressure type of pain?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I would say more like a sharp pain.
Like something sticking you in the side. Okay. You said it only lasts like 5 minutes or so?
Yeah. Okay. 5 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. This sounds to me, based on a number of things, it is good that you gave me the history of it happening over such a long period of time. You know, when I teach chest pain to medical students, we talk about anatomy and physiology. In other words, what is in that region where the symptom is of chest pain, and then what's the function of stuff that's going on there. And in and around where your heart is, there are a number of structures. Of course, the heart's one of the ones we're like, okay, we want to make sure this is not related to the heart itself. So you've got the heart itself and the blood supply to the heart where it can cause pain. There is the thin sac around the heart called the pericardium that the heart sort of sits in, and that can cause pain sometimes. You have the lungs and the lung tissue, and it's usually, from a pain standpoint, it's the covering of the lungs, so they sort of sit in a sac of their own. And it's called the parietal and visceral pleura. And then there are all the other structures between there and the outside of your body. So that is the ribs, the muscles in between your ribs. We call those the intercostal muscles. There are a number of blood vessels and veins in the in between your ribs too, usually on the lower side of the ribs that sort of run along there. And then the other things that are in the same vicinity are things like the esophagus, which is that long muscular tube that connects your throat to your stomach, and it sometimes can be the source of pain. The other thing that makes this a little bit confusing sometimes is sometimes organs will generate pain, but because of the way that the nerve supply is hooked up to them, it feels like that pain's coming from somewhere else. A good example of this is classic heart pain, angina, that usually presents as a crushing or pressure type pain that starts in your heart and goes down your left arm. And that has to do with the way those nerves are hooked up. It's not causing damage to the left arm per se, but it's because of the way those nerves are hooked up. By the description that you gave me, and because this is happening over time, you know, one thing is if you've been having this for 30 or 40 years, it's probably not from your heart, because it would have done, particularly if it was more serious things, it would have done damage to your heart over time, which would manifest in other ways. So that's a long time period to have that. And it tends to be self-limiting. It doesn't persist. You know, heart attacks, they persist, and you're going to know it because that pain's not going to get better that quickly. Sharp pain in and around anywhere in the chest, really, that starts really all of a sudden and it hurts to even breathe, most of the time is related to those muscles and the connections of those muscles to the bones and the bones to the other bones in the rib cage. So we call that costochondritis or muscular skeletal type pain. And it is just as painful as anything else. Like, it'll stop you in your tracks. And the reason why a lot of people can't breathe when they have that is because, just like if you've got a Charlie horse, is, you know, the sort of the vernacular, in your leg. So that is a spasm of one of the muscles in your leg, and you had a lot of pain with that. That's going to keep you from moving your leg. You can't move your leg back and forth. And what do? You sit down, you stop, you wait till that passes. Well, if it happens in between your ribs, the muscles, the intercostal muscles in your ribs, they contribute to breathing, not as much as your diaphragm does, but they do, and they move back and forth because you have to expand and contract your thoracic wall to breathe appropriately. Well, as you do that, those muscles, they can't rest. You can't just stop breathing. But when you take those breaths, that's why it hurts. Now, what causes this? Well, a lot of people have studied it and looked at, okay, what kind of things would predispose you to get that? In some instances, if you have electrolyte problems like lower potassium, calcium imbalances in your bloodstream, at least, sodium changes, you know, that can certainly do that. the biggest thing that people think is if you're mildly dehydrated, particularly with activity, you can see this, which is why a lot of athletes will say, hey, I went out and I ran 6 miles. I didn't drink or hydrate appropriately, and I got this stitch in my side. But it can occur at any time. What can you do? Relaxing while you have it. I would recommend, you know, drinking a glass of water or two right after that to make sure that you're hydrated, and then some gentle stretches. Like if it's where the point is, stretching that out a little bit can sometimes help. But I would put my money, David, on costochondritis in this instance, just because of the type, how you describe the symptoms, where they are, how long that's been happening, and the fact that it goes away in about 5 minutes, and that it's associated with increase in pain with deep breathing. So it is a self-limiting thing, but it doesn't make it any less painful.
Well, I appreciate it. I think that's all in all a good thing. Apparently, if it's not my heart, that's a good thing. So thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you for listening and calling. This is Southern Remedy. And I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart with you this morning, answering your calls and questions about any kind of healthcare activity that you are interested in. Maybe it's a new medication, new side effect. Maybe it's just an overall question about your healthcare or the healthcare of somebody else, or the healthcare system for that matter. We've got Cecilia, who's been patiently waiting on the line. Thank you, Cecilia, for waiting. What's your question this morning?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Dr. Jimmy. It's real simple. In the last year, my health has gone down. I've ended up in the hospital twice of seeing internal medicine, et cetera. You know, no one knows what's wrong, period. You know, you're there for 10 days each time in the hospital. The internal medicine doctor, when you go back, he says, oh, all the labs are fine. Okay, well then, a couple of hours later, his nurse practitioner calls and says, well, he really didn't review the labs. You know, he missed this, he missed this, you need to be on this medicine. And the other day, I was feeling so bad, and I mean, actually walking in a walker, really unsteady. So I went to an urgent care. You know, didn't expect much from them, but I expected at least some labs or something. And so she, you know, the woman says, "Oh, you know, at your age, you're probably anemic." She just says all these things. You're probably this, you're probably this, okay. And I'll call you tomorrow and tell you your labs. Well, the next day, she told me, you know, she had a nurse call and say one lab out of, you know, probably 40 that they did. And I didn't know the other. So I had a friend go there, pick up the labs, and probably half of them were either sky high or very low. So I'm having trouble trusting medicine.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with that word. I apologize that you had that experience, and certainly that would frustrate me too, to not having, number one, not having an answer. But what I'm hearing is, number two, having, you know, information that is contradictory from one person to the other, maybe even in the same office setting, and then also, you know, not that communication lapse. You got to have those that you got to have trust in the people who are taking care of you. And, you know, I think you probably could find somebody. It sounds like this trust may have been eroded in the people that you've gone to right now. Have they offered you someone else to go to as an alternative? Maybe that's accessible that might.
Now, when they hear, well, who's your primary care doctor? I say, I don't have I don't have one right now. Oh, well, you ought to find one, you know. And, you know, I've lived in, you know, Louisiana, North Carolina, Maine. I've never had trouble with medical problems.
Mm-hmm.
With you know, physicians, you know, being honest, being alert, et cetera, et cetera. I've never had that trouble. It's just in Mississippi. And I hate to say, you know, because this is our state, but, you know.
Yeah, I know of some good ones. I'm not as aware. I know you're in Harrison County. I know there, you know, there are some good ones around you. I would just be a little bit more. First of all, I would ask your friends, like, hey, who do you see for a doctor? And ask them what their experience is.
Well, that's the one I went to who didn't even look at the labs and had the nurse practitioner call me a couple hours later. I asked a friend. You know, I thought, okay, they go to him all the time. But then I guess they don't know.
Yeah. I'd ask some people, particularly the people who have gone, and not the healthy people, but I would ask the people who have gone through some things and say, hey, I've heard you talk about, you know, you've got diabetes and you've struggled with things, or your mom had a stroke. Who is their doctor?
Right.
Or who would you want your mother or your sister to go to if you had to? And I know it sounds like you did that and had a bad experience, but there's a lot of other good people out. And I'm honest, like, not everybody's going to have that experience. And even in the best of clinics, you know, I've had some of my patients that are like, I don't know that I really trust this clinic or the system for whatever reason. I am fine with patients going to see other people that they trust, because you have to have that to get good care. And you know that because you've had that experience in other places. But
right. I mean, I'm honest with them with whatever deal or whatever's going on. You know, I'm not hiding anything from them,
right,
et cetera.
Right.
So, I don't, you know. But you're just telling me to ask more around, I guess.
That's what I would do. I would do that. And maybe even if you, you know, if you have some friends who somebody in their family is a medical professional, those are good people to ask those questions too, because they sort of know the inside scoop.
My brother's a doctor, but he's, you know, way in another state.
Well, I meant the people that are there around you. Yeah.
No, I don't know.
Well, and again, I apologize that you've had that on behalf of all of medical care, but unfortunately sometimes these things happen, and disproportionately it seems like the same person has a number of negative experiences. But there are people out there that will take good care of you, that will try to communicate as best as they can, you know, sort of what the issues are that's going on. Certainly lab tests and other tests are very hard sometimes to do that, because there are so many things that flag out as abnormal but aren't clinically relevant. So, I think despite the experience that you've had, I think I'd reach out to a couple more people and say, hey, who would you send your mother, daughter, brother to, if they had some serious medical problems? So, all right, that is all the time we have for today. I do thank all of our callers for calling, and thank you for listening. Southern Remedy is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, Professor of Internal Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Southern Remedy is produced by Kevin Farrell. You can tune in to MPB Think Radio every weekday morning at 11 for the full Southern Remedy lineup.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.